KALW.
For better or worse, the fact that there is this investigation hanging over the mayor is probably going to influence a lot of people's decisions at the ballot box.
Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao is under a federal investigation.
They are looking for records related to Mayor Sheng Tao and her longtime partner, Andre Jones.
Today, an Oakland Side reporter talks about what we know so far. Then we hear the deep thoughts and feelings of a teenager with apraxia.
All my effort is not enough to get my body to obey. It runs wild, mad.
And we'll hear how a blind woodworker helps other visually impaired artists feel comfortable in the woodshop.
Your eyeballs don't run a saw. Your eyeballs don't create the project. Your brain does all those things.
Accessible art. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Since FBI agents raided the home of Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao, as well as the homes of businessmen David and Andy Duong, the U.S. Attorney's Office has subpoenaed text messages, voicemails, calendars, social media posts, handwritten notes, memos, faxes, and other documents related to the Duongs and their waste management company. But the raid and the subpoenas have raised more questions than they've answered. KALW News editor Sunni Khalid spoke with the Oakland Side reporter Eli Wolf about the expanding probe into the administration of Mayor Sheng Tao and its dealings with the Duong family.
So it is a big grab bag of things that they're looking for. But there's enough out there that we can start potentially connecting some dots, which I can do unless you have other questions.
Let's start connecting the dots. The old army base, which has been speculated. You've had people who have wanted to settle as many as 1,000 of Oakland's unhoused people at that base. These discussions have been going on for several years. Why would that be the target of a probe?
One possible reason that they're looking at the old army base is that we know that in 2022, maybe 2023, there were some companies that were looking at getting public dollars from the city to pay for temporary shelters for the unhoused in Oakland. One of the potential sites, it looks like at least one, maybe some other vendors were looking at, was the Oakland Army Base, which you cannot build at, or the city has determined that you cannot build housing on right now because it's contaminated with toxic waste. Remediating that would take millions of dollars. So to date, I believe the city hasn't moved forward with any plans to do that. But it looks like there were some companies that thought that maybe that could be done. We don't know for sure if Evolutionary Homes was looking at the old Oakland Army base as a place to build, but we do know that they approached the city about building shipping container homes for the unhoused. And it seems like they were looking to do it on surplus land owned by the city.
Now, connecting more dots, at least if we can listen to what the former chief of staff has said, she has talked about chaos in the mayor's office and an outsized role played by Andre Jones. How would that figure in any investigation?
You know, to be honest, I don't really know at this point. I think a big question mark for a lot of people is what kind of role did Andre Jones have, if any, in Mayor Tao's administration? We had a Q&A with the mayor last week, my colleague and I, and we asked her about the speculation that Andre Jones may have used his position as her partner to leverage favorable treatment for friends, contractors, what have you. And she said that she couldn't speak to that issue. So that is definitely something that we are still digging into, and hopefully we'll find more concrete information that will shed some light about what role, if any, he had in this.
So how was the talk with the mayor? Was she as defiant as she was at that press conference right after the raid?
You know, I don't know if she was defiant. She was more upbeat, I would say. I think she's had some time to kind of settle into this reality. And very much what she was focusing on in the interview, at least, were the accomplishments in her administration over the last 18 months. Obviously, she has been dealt some very difficult challenges. You know, she started her administration and a few weeks in, fired her police chief, who is now suing the city, who is also running for a city council seat. She dealt with a ransomware attack. The city fumbled this state grant for additional police resources. We're now two budgets in to a very bad deficit that the city is still trying to figure out on a structural level. So she was very focused on figuring out sort of her steps forward to bring Oakland to a more stable, prosperous place. She also, I think, is thinking in terms of the recall effort. We know that the mayor is going to be facing a recall election in November. The FBI raids are going to hang very heavy over her head during that campaign. And we asked her about that. And she said, I believe that she couldn't predict what would happen, but she didn't see or identify any mistakes that I think she saw as precluding her from beating the recall. Overall, very optimistic in tone, not pessimistic.
What's next? Is there a timeline at all, generally, with these kinds of investigations, or is each investigation different?
Unfortunately, there's not really a hard and fast timeline that we can rely on here. It could be months before the federal grand jury forwards information to investigators to determine whether to file indictments, if that's what they choose to do. They could sit on this for a while and nothing could end up happening. I think there's pressure right now for something conclusive to be said about what, if any, wrongdoing has been identified, because there is this recall election. And for better or worse, the fact that there is this investigation hanging over the mayor is probably going to influence a lot of people's decisions at the ballot box and whether they want to give her the second half of her term to complete. So right now, we are very much in the dark. We'll just have to see what federal investigators say in the coming weeks and months. We do know that the city has a deadline for when it's supposed to turn in the records that were requested in the latest subpoena, and that's on the 25th of this month in July. So more records are going to investigators who will decide what to do after that.
We're focused on Shang Tao, but the Duongs also had their homes raided, the father and the son. They have a $1 billion contract with the city to do recycling. What do you see as is there a focus on California Waste Solutions? Is it on Evolutionary Homes? Is it on the business practices of the Duongs, which Oakland side has covered extensively? What are we looking at there?
Again, we don't know exactly what investigators are targeting here in terms of what they think might be wrongdoing, but we do have a few things that we know the Duongs have done that might be of interest to them. So, for example, Evolutionary Homes, this is something we've reported about recently. The Duongs were in business with Evolutionary Homes, which again was building these shipping container homes for the homeless. It appears their partner in this business was a guy named Mario Juarez, who's a local businessman, a political candidate in Oakland, kind of a colorful figure. The business appeared to have some kind of dispute between the Duongs and Juarez. We know that on May 3rd, there was some kind of altercation that happened outside of the company headquarters. Mario Juarez has claimed that the Duongs had people. Well, first, he claimed that he was illegally locked out of his company and that he confronted the Duongs about it. He says that the Duongs had people beat him up and rob him outside of the building and force him to make a videotaped apology to David Duong, who is sort of the patriarch of the family. He's the founder and owner of California Waste Solutions. That's what he's alleging.
This sounds like some authoritarian third world regime.
It's pretty outlandish, but, you know, reality can be stranger than fiction.
It's Oaklandish.
Again, these are allegations. We do not know what actually happened. The Duongs claim that Mario actually threatened them, that he had a gun on him, and said that he had, quote, cartel people that were around the company building. This is something that I believe Andy Duong alleged in a police report. David Duong, in a letter to the Port, just disputed everything that Juarez had said to them. About a month after this altercation allegedly took place, Mario claims that someone took a shot at him or shots at him outside of his home in Oakland. He told police that he believed that this might have been related to an investigation. He didn't elaborate on what that meant. But a couple weeks after that alleged shooting took place, the FBI raided the homes of David and Andy Duong and the mayor and the building where California Waste Solutions has offices. So people are focusing on Evolutionary Homes right now because it seems like there may have been violence involved with this company, some kind of dispute. There's a lot going on with it.
Well, you've shed a lot of light on the role that the Duongs have played in local politics. They had quite an extensive list of political contributions, including $250,000 to the Trump campaign 4 years ago. But the list of contributors is almost like a who's who of Bay Area politics.
This ties into another thing that the Duongs are actually currently being investigated for, which is because the family does business with Oakland, they've been barred from giving money to local candidates in recent years. This is a measure that Oakland has in place, like many other cities, to prevent quid pro quo arrangements where contractors give money to candidates and maybe expect favorable treatment in return. So what the Public Ethics Commission in Oakland has alleged in an investigation that started in 2019 is they believe that Andy Duong was running a what they call a straw donor scheme, where he was basically reimbursing people to give money to candidates, to political committees that he and his family supported but weren't legally allowed to contribute money to. And they gave allegedly tens of thousands of dollars through this scheme to several Oakland City Council members, including Sheng Tao, who was on the council at the time that this was allegedly taking place. So in addition to that, yes, they've also given legal donations on the state and federal level, and maybe most noteworthy in the state, they gave to Rob Bonta, California's attorney general, who recently gave back, I think it was in the range of around $150,000 of contributions that he'd received from the family. So they are prolific in the way they use their money.
That was the Oakland Side reporter Eli Wolf speaking with KALW News editor Sunni Khalid. Find all our coverage of Oakland politics at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. It's Disability Pride Month, and today we're bringing you the words of Alameda poet Lucian Gonzalez. 16-year-old Lucian describes himself as a non-speaking autistic person. He loves watching NPR Tiny Desk concerts, traveling to new places, and writing poetry. Lucian worked with a KALW producer to create this audio essay, weaving together two of his poems. They're voiced by KALW's Hussein Khan.
All my effort is not enough to get my body to obey. It runs wild, mad, lion, predator. All my effort is not enough to get my body to race. To fly high, free, bat, high flying. All my effort is not enough to get my body to calm. No gentle healing, peaceful, feline, languorous. Because I can't speak, the default assumption is that I also can't think or understand. Like most non-speaking students, I was placed in isolated special classes at school and given really low-level academics year after year. I was most often treated like a toddler, even in middle school. This treatment was unimaginably painful, as it was based on a terrible misunderstanding about my disability. I'm not stupid, but I have apraxia, which is an inability to perform purposeful actions, including the purposeful action of speech. It basically means my body doesn't obey instructions from my brain. So, for example, when I really want to stay sitting to learn in school, my body might stand up and run away, and then people assume I'm not paying attention. It is too frustrating. It took years of hard work to learn to purposely point to letters one by one on a letterboard to spell out my thoughts, which is how I wrote this piece. My life changed when I found a way to communicate at age 11. Finally, I was really seen for who I am. There are so many others just like me. Research shows that a high percentage of autistic people also have apraxia, and other non-speakers who are able to communicate describe similar experiences to mine. So why don't we know more about it? The fact is that most autism research focuses on people who speak. We need more research about apraxia and its connection to non-speaking autism. And we need to stop assuming that people who lack speech also lack understanding and intelligence. The segregation in education must end, and non-speaking students must be given access to age-appropriate curriculum. The inability to speak and control one's body well is not indicative of a person's capacity and desire to learn. These outdated and biased beliefs about our disability cause immense suffering for way too many people. Reckoning of Villanelle. People gotta feel good about themselves somehow. Face value stereotypes ease their way. As for me, really, I got to take a bow. So many misconceptions follow me around. To some, I'll only ever be dumb as rock. People gotta feel good about themselves somehow. Inside, my thoughts blossom, stretch, abound. But other minds remain rigid and closed. As for me, really, I got to take a bow. The ones who believe, who change, who can allow their mistake and honestly undertake their reckoning will feel good about themselves somehow. I see colors with voices. I think purple sound. Realizing my brain is something uniquely equipped, that is why, really, I got to take a bow. I can't squander my spirit, demolishing doubt. To those narrow minds who always refuse to see, people gotta feel good about themselves somehow. And with this poem, I've taken my bow.
That piece was written by Lucian Gonzalez and voiced by KALW's Hussein Khan. It was produced by Molly Blair Salyer. You can find more of our stories celebrating Disability Pride Month at kalw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we're going to a stretch of land in Napa County that's been a sanctuary for visually impaired people for over 70 years. The Enchanted Hills Camp was founded in 1950. It's a place where blind children and adults can swim, dance, play music, ride horses, and use a wood shop. Reporter Hannah Kingsley Ma visited the man at the heart of its woodworking program a few years back.
In the gallery below his woodshop, master woodworker George Wurzel has two portraits of himself on display. The first is like a scarecrow, hung in an antique wooden closet, a flannel shirt under a worn pair of overalls, pockets stuffed with tools.
I just thought it represented me, because that's me. I mean, I just... when you see me on the street, that's my normal garb.
The second is made up of 4,000 wood screws, drilled into a board at varying levels so it becomes a three-dimensional projection of George's face, his straw hat, his big bushy beard. It makes a kind of musical chime when you run your hands over it.
So this is what your self-portrait sounds like?
Yeah, that's what I sound like.
This is a haptic gallery. All of the works are made to be touched. George is blind. He lost his sight as a little kid. And the beautiful things he makes out of wood, he wants you to experience them the same way he does, like this gnarled chunk of a redwood burl.
Now, if you take your thumb and forefinger and spin this in your hand, you will feel all of those lumps and bumps and curls.
To pull out the texture of sanded wood, he mists it with water so that the grain puffs up. He can tell by the swirls of fungus that a piece of wood has color.
The rot and the worms will both cause there to be different colors in the wood. And that's one of the things that I can't see, but that's one of the things I always inquire and ask about.
But George isn't just the creator of these objects. He's also a teacher at the Enchanted Hills Camp, which is now owned by the Lighthouse Center for the Blind. Upstairs above the gallery, there's a whole class of adults without sight using power tools. George has lived most of his life without being able to see, but many of his students lost their vision much later in life and have had to relearn how to do certain things.
The only thing I always tell people that I teach is just how to feel confident with yourself.
Because regardless of what your vision is like, he says there's only one way to use a piece of equipment, the right way.
Your eyeballs don't run a saw. Your eyeballs don't create the project. Your brain does all those things.
There's a mixture of sighted and blind instructors. George brought in Jerry Cremeau to teach students how to use a lathe, a rotating tool that allows you to carve out round shapes, not because he has his vision, but because he's an expert in it. Their technique is the same.
Your eyes don't work, but still, your fingers do, and you know how thick this is, and you know how it should feel in weight.
And I would have made the rim thinner, but I got scared.
The only thing that's noticeably different are the measuring tools, called click rulers.
It essentially is a round pipe with another piece of material that slides in and out of the round pipe with threads, 16 threads to the inch.
George's students are from all over, but none have traveled quite as far as Faye and Devi, who's here in the Bay Area to work on a project in collaboration with SF MoMA.
I'm originally from New Zealand, but I live in Australia now, and I'm an artist. I work mostly with blindness, trying to understand how blindness can generate new artistic and curatorial methods of practice.
Fayeen says when she started to lose her vision, she had to rethink her whole approach to art.
I mean, I went through a period a few years ago where I got quite depressed because I was really scared and thought, I was making these kinds of paintings that involve really detailed engraving that would take me months to make a tiny work. And I was also making books. And I just, my instant reaction was, well, I'm not going to be able to do either of those. But after a period of thinking about it, I realized, well, I can just start making paintings in a different way.
But she was still nervous about using a wood shop.
I was excited about coming here and particularly this weekend about actually using some power tools, which I've stayed away from since my vision dropped.
She trusts George, his years of experience and the reputation of Enchanted Hills Camp.
He does really simple things, like he tied a rubber band around one end so that I couldn't move my hand past that point, which means it wouldn't be cut off. You know, they're really basic things, but doing that, I knew I kind of had the framework to be able to just give it a go.
Becoming visually impaired has also changed the way she thinks about how accessible art is. Like, for instance, audio descriptions at museums that describe what a painting looks like if you can't see it. This is one from the Museum of Modern Art.
Water lilies. Oil on canvas.
Each of the canvases is completely devoted to water. The edge of the pond is never shown. It's a mysterious, shifting world.
Fayeen says, especially as an artist, she has a hard time accepting there's one right way to describe an artwork.
Because I still do have some vision, sometimes I hear these and I think they're totally wrong. So therefore, if that's the position that I'm in, you know, I don't want to get to the point where I see less well and I'm just being told I have to accept, you know, this third person's description of this work.
Places that display art can feel really unwelcoming. Like there's a specific way you're supposed to behave in galleries. Fayeen has learned to be wary of their alarms.
Because for me to see the paintings, I have to be pretty close, so I set those things off all the time.
Fayeen is here at the workshop working on a piece to broaden the way in which we experience art, informed in part by her life as a visually impaired person. She and a couple of others are making canes of different kinds of wood, with different kinds of knobs. Some jagged, some smooth, one that looks like the end of a honey dipper. And they're scraping them along the gallery floor, along the walls and the furniture. Imagine it kind of like an auditory or sensory dance piece. You'll be able to listen to and feel the movement of these canes from their big swooping sounds and their rattling vibrations.
So at the moment, we're just trying to figure out which canes give us information in different ways, and then we can hone the most useful ideas. Yeah. Jennifer, can I try that one
there?
Yeah,
go for it. Yeah. Okay. What's that?
It's sort of like, it reminds me of drawing a bow over a string.
Outside the building where Fayin and her peers are practicing, there's a pond where campers can swim and a huge outdoor amphitheater where people gather for bonfires. Even some roaming goats that help graze the grass for fire abatement. George Wurzel, the woodworking teacher, lives here full-time. He came here after a career of architectural millwork, in part because of his own childhood experience in a camp for the blind in Michigan.
I love teaching kids that you shouldn't let people tell you what to do that don't have to live with the consequences of it. You know, you need to make those decisions as to what you want to be and who you want to do. And don't let other people tell you what they think you should do. You should figure those things out for yourself.
Hannah's story first aired in 2018. George Wurzel has since moved on from the Enchanted Hills camp, but they're continuing their flagship blindness skills immersion training camp. We'll have a link to the details at klw.org/crosscurrents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Hussein Khan, Arun Nair, Julia Haney, Nigar Ajayabi, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.